The Jewish orphan Esther stood out because of her beauty, but God had bigger, more important plans for her, even beyond becoming queen of Persia. It was Esther's loyalty and courage that God used to steer the destiny of an entire nation, and ultimately the world. In a three-part series, Northgate explores lessons from the life of a woman who was set apart, God's perfect work through imperfect people.
How you doing? You good? Enjoy the weather? It's good. We got a nice, we're on an every other schedule, right? It was ice storm, really nice. Snow last week, really nice again. It's bad news for next week, but it's good news for today. I tried to get Anthony to stay out with me, but he's smarter than that. You might have thought when he was leading worship, he doesn't look a day over 35, but he is because he turned 36 today. So here's what I thought since we all hear him. Yeah, congratulations. We all hear him sing all the time. I thought it would be fun if when you see him in the lobby or wherever, you just sing happy birthday to him. So let him hear you sing, and he will literally appreciate that, especially if a lot of you do that. But he does so much for the church here. You see the worship side of it. A lot of people don't know the creative side that he's involved with videos and with things like the set design and a lot of the decoration and different things around the church. And he has a great team with Sarah and Tara and Lucas, and he does a great job with them. But he has his hand in so many things here, and they're all done really, really well. So honor him and celebrate him. And he never quite catches up to me. Like, he gets close in age, but he doesn't quite catch up. It's really sad. So we are in a series. We're actually starting a new series called Set Apart. I got to fix this TV. There's a marker here. Hold on. This is bad stage stuff, but I got to get it on the spot because I like things right. Okay, so we're in a series called Set Apart, and if you don't come to Northgate a lot or you're new here, you're trying to figure this out, we go through and we either do books of the Bible, sometimes we'll do topics through books of the Bible, and we group them together. It might be 3 weeks, like this one is, that's about the shortest we do, might be as long as 7-8 weeks. We did a 10-week Ten Commandments series because that made sense, and we put them all together and we learn through this particular topic and book. And so we are going to look at the book of Esther, and today we get to kind to set the stage for that as we start to go through. Now, I asked, we have a 9 o'clock meeting with our volunteers and our staff, and I asked them what they knew about Esther. And I don't want to throw them under the bus other than to say, I came away thinking, good, we have a lot to learn about Esther, because they didn't know a ton about her. A lot of people, most people had not ever heard a message or a series on Esther, but it's a great book. It's a really great book, as you're going to see over the next 3 weeks. So let me give you some background. As you probably are able to guess, the central figure in this account is... Good job. All right, nice job. Now, that's a trick question, too, though, because if you read the book of Ruth, I feel like Naomi is the main figure. So don't always, you were right today, but just know that same logic might not always get you there. And Esther is a young Jewish woman. When we're reading a book, we always want to know who the author is. That's actually unclear. It's anonymously written. There's at least a chance that it was authored by Esther's cousin Mordecai. He's one of the characters that we'll get to know better over the next couple of weeks. And there's no proof necessarily that he did, but there are people that think he did, and he certainly would have had the information to be able to write this. This is a historical book. There's a great deal of confirmation from secular history that these events really did happen. The kings and the people in the story are real people, and the time frames are right. So it's authentic history. It's not legend. It's not myth. But it is recorded in a way that kind of makes it a living parable that can apply to our lives and to things going on there. As far as the time period, this is after the Babylonian captivity. If you remember our Daniel series last fall, they were in the Babylonian captivity where Babylon had taken some of the people from Jerusalem. They brought them there. This is after that. Persia has defeated Babylon. Now it's the Persian Empire. They're the big dog at that time, and that's where we are. If it all takes place in Susa, which is one of the capital cities of Persia. There's all these different provinces because it's a big worldwide empire. And Susa is one of the capital cities. And if you're looking for other books in like a similar time frame to compare those, Ezra and Nehemiah would both be books around the same time. And so at this point in the exile, some of the Jews had started to return to Jerusalem. Many of them were still there. Esther and Mordecai would be two Jews that were still in Persia. They had not returned. And the Jewish people, as they frequently have been in their history, were a minority. And because of that, they were viewed with suspicion. They were mistreated. It was not a good time or a good place to be a Jew. But one of the most interesting things I think about the book of Esther as we introduce it is what's not in Esther. Because I was talking to Chris Landon, who is one of our pastors at Arbor House, and he's like really young, but also has this amazing understanding of the Old Testament. I don't know if he qualifies as Old Testament scholar yet, but he's way closer than me, and he will be there someday. And what he was saying is, you know, there's five major themes when we go through the Old Testament. You read the Old Testament at all, you see themes of God and Yahweh. We see the theme of the covenant, of the temple, of sacrifice, and of prayer. Those are very predominant Old Testament themes. None of those five things are mentioned at all in the book of Esther. None of them make any appearance or even mention there. There's no reference to worship or to faith. There is no prophecy of Jesus. A lot of the Old Testament books have this foretelling of the Messiah that would come. That does not happen in Esther. And there's no mention of heaven or hell. And so you might be asking at this point, well, why is it included in the Bible? And I think there are some great reasons, and I hope after the next 3 weeks that that's really clear for you. But one of the reasons that I think it's included in the Bible is our main point this morning, and that's that sometimes God is silent, but he is never still. There are times, there are places where we feel that God is silent, where that is definitely how it feels to us. And we won't see the name of God written on the pages of Esther. We won't hear his name spoken in this book, but we cannot confuse that with thinking that he's not at work here, because he is at work, and God is sovereign. Now, sovereign's kind of a church word that you don't hear outside of church too much, unless you're saying like a sovereign nation, right? That's probably the only time people would use it. But what that means, quite simply said, is that God is in control. God is in control, and he's not just kind of in control. He's not mostly in control. It doesn't work like that. Control is an all or nothing proposition. Either you are in control or you are not in control. So there's no such thing as God being mostly sovereign. He has every detail covered. And I think for a lot of Christ followers, we know that, and we believe that, and we've seen it, but we also know that there are times, there are stages where God is silent, or at very least where it feels like God is silent. We pray, we wait, we listen, we even cry out, and it feels like nothing more than an exercise in futility. And I believe that we will see throughout this story over the next 3 weeks that even in the times when God is silent, that he is never still. He is still at work. He is still working his purposes together for the good of those that love him and are called according to his purpose. And on top of that, here's what I, and also Philip Yancey, would suggest, is that not only can God be at work during those silent times, he actually does some of his very best work during those times. Here's what Philip Yancey says about that. The kind of faith God values seems to develop best when everything fuzzes over, when God stays silent, when the fog rolls in. Some of you have experienced that. You've lived that out. That when God, what God does during those times of silence is that he's working behind the scenes and he's deepening and he's developing our faith frequently in the most profound ways that our faith is deepened and developed. So let's take a look at this account of maturing faith and this account of ensuing growth at a time when God was so silent that his name was not even mentioned. Now we're going to go through Esther 1 and 2 today. And I'm just going to kind of share that story with you. I'm going to a couple times reference the particular verses, but in large part, I'm not. I always encourage you, be informed listeners. If you want to open to Esther 1 and 2, you could follow along pretty easily, or you can read that later. But those are good things to do just to make sure I'm not making stuff up here. You can at least see how I got to where I got with this. Now, it starts out by saying all of this took place during the time of King Xerxes. He is in his third year as the king, and his reign is going pretty well. well. Things are so good that he decides he needs to celebrate by throwing this huge party. So he invites all the most important people in the kingdom. He invites the nobles and the princes. He invites everybody that needs to be there, the military leaders. And they have a party for 180 days. They have a six-month party. Man, I like if I get a three-day weekend, you know, like that feels good. These guys, six-month party, they're really getting after it. And he shows off for his friends, you know, which is a pretty common thing. It says that he displays the vast wealth of his kingdom and the splendor and the glory of his majesty. And so I don't know what that makes you think of. When I read that, I pictured like an old school rap video where they're like, they got all the jewelry and they got like the Lamborghini and the Ferrari and they got the money, right? And he's making it rain. Like, I don't know. That's what I pictured with King Xerxes. He's got like an old school rap video with all his friends and he's showing off. It says they're serving wine in gold goblets. And it says that the royal wine was abundant because the king had commanded the wine stewards to let everyone drink without restrictions. Which made me think of a Bills tailgate, if you've ever gone there. Apparently King Xerxes is big in the Bills tailgates. So it's a very similar policy. So he's got an open bar, he's got this big fancy party, he's got all his friends there. And then on the other side, his wife, the queen, Vashti, she also is having a banquet for the women in the royal palace. So you've got the men's party over here with King Xerxes. Queen Vashti has her party with the women on the other side. And when King Xerxes is very drunk, it says he was high in spirits from wine, he commanded seven of his guys to bring Queen Vashti wearing her royal crown in order to display her beauty to the people. It says, for she was lovely to look at. Now, if you read that, you just go through and you're going to be like, oh, okay, got it. What you would miss in the interpretation of the language is he was asking that she be brought wearing only her crown. And so this word gets to her. The attendants go and they try and carry that out and they say, Queen Vashti, this is what the king has asked. And she refuses to come. And let's just say here, one, she's a woman ahead of her time, and two, good for Queen Vashti, right? Good for her being like, no, I'm not doing that, right? You stay in your man party, we got our woman party over here, like talking about essential oils and all this stuff. It's good. We don't need, I'm not going to do that. And she refuses to come. That's stereotyping. She refuses to come, but I think it's important to say that being married or being in a relationship is never permission to be exploited. And like I said, she was way ahead of her time. Just in case you thought that powerful men exploiting women was a relatively new thing, it is not a new thing. Hopefully it is something that we are closer to ending than at any other point in history. It's something that we've started to stand up against and refuse to normalize and accept. But that's not a new thing, and that's what the king was trying to do. And she put her foot down. She was a strong woman and said, I'm not going to do that. And guess what happened to this powerful, wealthy man when he was told no? He gets mad. He burns with anger. He's furious. He has a fit. And he brings his lawyers in and he consults with all the experts in the matters of law and justice. And he says, what should we do and what could we do to deal with this? And one of them speaks up. And King Xerxes has this great way of surrounding himself with people who only tell him what he wants to hear, which can happen for people, especially people that are powerful. And he says, Queen Vashti has done wrong, not only against you, king, but against all the nobles and all the people and all the provinces of your kingdom. And not only that, when word of her behavior here reaches all women, when they hear she said no to the king, all of them will start saying no to their husbands. They will all say, King Xerxes commanded Queen Vashti to be brought before him, and she did not come. And then it says, there will be no end to the disrespect and discord. So this obviously appeals to the king, and here's what his proposal is because of all that. He says, therefore, if it pleases the king, let him issue a royal decree and let it be written in the laws of Persia and Media, which cannot be repealed, that Vashti is never again to enter the presence of King Xerxes. Also, let the king give her royal position to someone who is better than she. Then, when the king's edict is proclaimed through all his vast realm, all the women will respect their husbands from the least to the greatest. Guys, free advice. If you want to be respected by your wife, you could issue a decree like this in all the land and send that out. Or you could treat your wife like a person and not an object, and you could treat your marriage like a partnership. And that's a great way for all husbands to be respected from the least to the greatest. And it depends on how you live that out, on what you live and what you see. Our oldest daughter, Grace, who's 8 now, I think she was 7 when this happened, we were playing the card game War. And I was explaining it to her, and she's getting it. Okay, so I got a 7, and you got a 6, I win. Like, we go through that. And I played a king, and she played a queen, and I went to take him, and she was like, whoa, hey. Why does the king beat the queen? And I was like, oh, well, throughout history, males have dominated society and kept women down. Like, so it's one step below. And she did not really accept that because she's lived in our house, and she knows that Amy is a very strong, capable woman. And so I had to try to explain to her why the king was above the queen in the game. But the king, he wasn't interested in earning or deserving respect. His nobles weren't interested in that. And so he and his nobles were very pleased with this legal advice, with what the lawyer had advised. So he sends dispatches out to every part of the kingdom, to each province, written in their own language, proclaiming that every man should be the head of his household. I won't give you the exact words, but the point, the gist of that was, dear everyone, boys rule, girls rule, sincerely the king. Like, this is what he wrote, and he sent it out to everyone. And this is a huge kingdom. Like, this is a very vast kingdom. It's the entire Middle East. It's Northern Africa. It's part of Europe. It's a big chunk of Asia, and he sends that out to everyone to let them all know that the men are in charge, because he is not at all insecure, and that is not at all an overreaction to being told no one time. So later on, the king sobers up, and as he gets more sober after the six-month party, he starts to have a clearer mind, and he thinks, shoot, I don't have a wife now. Like, I banished her from ever being near me again, so I need to fix that. And his personal attendants, they say, let's have a search of all the beautiful young virgins for the king. Just in case you thought The Bachelor was a relatively new idea, that's also not. That's old. That's been around. They said, well, the king can appoint commissioners from every province, and they will gather up all the most beautiful women, and they will bring them here to Susa. And we'll hook them up with one of the king's attendants. We'll give them beauty treatments. We'll get them ready for the king. And whichever young woman pleases the king will become the queen instead of Vashti. And it says this advice appealed to the king, so he followed it. That's kind of like the story of King Xerxes. Somebody gives him advice, and he's like, I like that. That sounds good. We always need to be surrounded by people who can tell us when we're out of line. You need to have that. No matter if you're the top person in your organization, the bottom, whatever you do, you have to have people that can go, hey, yeah, that's a bad idea, right? Somebody needed to say, hey, Xerxes, I understand that you like how that sounds. That's actually human trafficking, so we should not do that. But no one had that. No one had that position. They're all like, this is great, king. This is what we should do. And to be clear, and I'm really sorry to VeggieTales, there's nothing romantic or sweet about this, right? There's no good love story here. This is not a love story. I mean, if we imagine if one of these girls that was taken from her homeland just for being young and beautiful so that she could be exploited for this competition with the hopes of maybe winning so she can be exploited by the king on a more regular basis, if we imagine one of those girls as our daughters, it suddenly doesn't feel like a good love story. Now, at this point in the account, we learn that right in the area of Susa, there's a Jewish man named Mordecai, who I mentioned earlier, and later on, he's going to become a pretty big player in all of this. Esther 2:7 introduces us to Mordecai in this way. It says he had a cousin named Hadassah, whom he had brought up because she had neither father nor mother. This young woman, who was also known as Esther, had a lovely figure and was beautiful. Mordecai had taken her as his own daughter when her father and mother died. So we see Mordecai, and Mordecai is caring for his cousin. He's adopted her in a way. Her name is Esther. And every time Esther's mentioned, it goes out of the way to kind of mention that she's beautiful. So we don't have pictures. Let me get the picture Bible. We don't have that, but suffice it to say, she was probably an attractive young woman. And so the king's orders get out there, and the young women start to be brought to the citadel of Susa for their beauty treatments. Because before they could go before to see King Xerxes, they had to go through 12 months of beauty treatments prescribed for the women. They had to do 6 months with oil of myrrh and 6 months of perfumes and cosmetics just to be able to see the king. So, ladies, if your husband complained about how long it took you to get ready for church today, I just want you to know, tell him it could be worse. And one of these young women that is brought to the citadel of Susa and is going through this is a young woman named Esther. we just met. And on first sight, it says the first time the king saw her, she won his favor. Immediately, he gives her special treatment. He provides her extra beauty treatments. He gives her special food. He takes 7 female attendants and assigns them just to her, and he puts them in the best place in the harem. And again, that might sound good, but this is a bad guy doing bad things. And it mentions that Esther had not revealed her nationality to this point. Mordecai had forbidden her to do so, and so she just casually failed to mention that she was Jewish. And every day, Mordecai would walk back and forth near the courtyard of the harem to find out how she was, to find out what was happening with her. He kept this relationship with her, and he couldn't be a part of that, but he would just kind of walk outside, and they would talk and keep appraised of her life. Now, eventually, all the women would have the opportunity to go to the king. In the evening, she would go there. In the morning, she would return to the group of women. And she would only return to the king after that if he was pleased with her and he summoned her specifically by name. And so when Esther's turn came to go to the king, it says that everyone who saw her, she won their favor. Again, she just, whether it's beauty and charm and elegance and grace, whatever it is, everyone that sees her, she wins their favor. And here's what it says about the king and how he viewed Esther. He was attracted to Esther more than any of the other women, and she won his favor and approval more than any of the other virgins. So he set a royal crown on her head, and he made her queen instead of Vashti. And the king, he loves a good party, so he has a new queen, and now he throws another party for all the nobles and officials, and this time it's in Esther's honor. It's her banquet, and he proclaims it as a holiday throughout the whole kingdom, and he distributes gifts to everyone and has this big celebration because Esther's the new queen. And so, yay, but also not really yay, right? It's still not a great thing. And she continues to keep her secret about her nationality as Mordecai had told her to. Now, at the end of chapter 2, it ends with this thing that seems like a side note, maybe a somewhat insignificant side note, but it will end up being really crucial in the whole picture. Mordecai likes to hang out at the king's gate. That's kind of his place, right? He hangs out at the king's gate, and people come and go, and you get some of this, hear some of the action and the things that are going on there. And one of the days, when he just happens to be hanging out there, he overhears two of the king's guards, two of the officials, and they're angry with the king. And they're angry enough with the king that he hears them begin to conspire to assassinate the king. And so Mordecai, when he goes to visit Esther, he tells Queen Esther about this situation. He tells her about the guys and what he heard, and he passes that on. And she, in turn, reports that to King Xerxes, making sure to give credit to Mordecai. And the king's people, they investigate the report. They find it to be a credible threat on the king's life, and so they take these two officials and they impale them on poles, as you do. And then it ends with this important footnote. It says, all of this is recorded in the book of the annals in the presence of the king. And so it's like this journal of events for the king's life, where at the end they go through and they write everything out, so the king has this kind of written journal about what has happened in his life. And it gets noted that two officials had conspired to assassinate him, but some guy named Mordecai found a way to let the king know, and he saved his life. And that gets written in that book. And that's as far as we get to carry the story today. If you want to know what happens, and we're not done, so don't like zip up your coat and stuff yet. If you want to know what happens, you got two options. You can come back the next 2 weeks. I would highly recommend that. You also, if you're more impatient than that, you could read the rest of Esther yourself in your Bible. It's a highly recommended activity. Or you could do both. But there are a few things that I want to kind of unpack about this account today. And first and foremost, and you'll see this progress even more as we go throughout this book, but this book goes so far in revealing how God can work behind the scenes, what God can do. Because remember, there is no mention of him. We don't hear about him. We don't hear about what he is doing. And yet he is at work. Because as I told you at the beginning, sometimes God is silent, but he is never still. This book of Esther is a great case study in how God can work through natural means, of how he can bring about his will through free will choices of whatever people he wants. God can use anyone that he wants to advance his story and to advance your story and my story. And one of the most interesting parts of Esther's story is how God used people who were clearly not trying to bring about his purposes in the world to bring about his purposes in the world. I think that's fascinating, and that's how God works. And I want you to know this morning that that is what God is doing in your life, even if you don't know it, even if you don't know it. Rachel Myers said this in a blog post about Esther. She said, "We serve a God who designs our deliverance before man can begin to devise our destruction." That's the God that we serve, and that's really good news because some of you, you feel the destruction being devised. You're well aware of that. You know that part, and you are wondering if deliverance really is in the works, and I want you to know that it is, and I want you to know that the God we serve had that in the works before any of this began. And so if you're in one of those struggles today, if you're somebody that is identifying with God being silent, with God being distant, with God being far, and you're wondering if he is still at work, I want to give you God's word for you today through the prophet Isaiah in Isaiah 41:10. This is what he says. "So do not fear, for I am with you. Do not be dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you and help you. I will uphold you with my righteous right hand." Should we not fear because there's no bad people out there? Should we not fear because there's no bad circumstances? Or should we not fear because we have this abiding confidence that bad things never happen to good people? No. It says, do not fear. Why? For I am with you, and for I am your God. That's why we should not fear. Should we not fear because we're incredibly strong people and we can handle anything that comes our way and we can take it on? No, that's not what it says. It says we should not fear because God will strengthen us and he will uphold us and he will help us. I want you to know today that God has not walked away from you. I want you to know that God has not walked away, even if he's silent, even if you haven't heard him. He has not walked away. He is still good and he is still in control and he can still work in your life through this, through whatever that is. I have an unending confidence that God is still at work in your life and God is still at work in your story. And I pray that God gives you that same confidence. And to everyone here that's not in a struggle, to everyone here that things are good and maybe things have been good for a while and things are going well, I celebrate that with you. And I have some instructions for you though as well because this is important. If God is good, if God is near, if things are going well, what I implore you to do is to memorize the terrain right now, to look around and memorize this. Because here's what I know about most of us. You can walk through your bedroom at night when it's completely dark, especially if you're married. If you get up and go to the bathroom at night, you don't turn the light on, right? If you do, you're probably a terrible spouse because that's really rough. But if you come in, you know, you go to bed after your spouse, you don't turn the light on. If you get up early, you don't turn. You've learned. You've looked around and you've said, okay, this is how it looks. Last night I got back from church late, and by the time I got back, all the girls were in bed and Amy was asleep and I stayed up and watched a baseball game for a while. And when I went into my room, it was pitch black. But I know when I walk in there that there's a dresser there and that there's a bed there and there's a space about that big to walk through. And I did that and I navigated that and I plugged my phone in and I got all my stuff and I was able to walk well throughout the room in the dark. Why? Because I've memorized what that room looks like in the light. I know what it looks like and we do not rearrange our bedroom. That's a losing plan. We need to memorize what God looks like in the light. When things are good, when we hear God, when he's close with us, when we're experiencing that relationship in a great way with him, we have to memorize what that looks like and how that feels. We have to decide right now for sure that he is a good and loving God who wants what's best for us. Because remember that he is a God that loved us enough to send his son. He loved us enough to send his son, and that is actually a huge advantage that we have over Esther. And that's a huge advantage we have over Mordecai and over Isaiah and over anybody else in the Old Testament. Because all of them had to look forward to the promise of the Messiah. All of them have this incredible faith that they lived out, but the whole time they're looking forward and saying, someday God is going to send his chosen one to redeem us and to redeem our brokenness. And we look forward to that. We anticipate that. But here's what the author of Hebrews says in chapter 11, 39 and 40. It says, all of them, the people we mentioned and all the other heroes of the faith in the Old Testament, these were all commended for their faith. Yet none of them received what had been promised, since God had planned something better for us, so that only together with us would they be made perfect. None of them had received what was promised yet. None of them could look back at Jesus, and none of them could look back at the cross and look back at the sacrifice that he had made for us. But here we stand today, all of us, on the other side of that. On the other side of a time where it felt like God had completely lost control, like he had totally taken his hands off the wheel, like it was completely dark and completely silent as his son was murdered. I mean, on the list of dark and silent times from God, there is no time more dark or more silent than Jesus' death. At no time has it appeared more like God was not in control than on those 3 days. But remember what I told you. God can use people who are clearly not trying to bring about his purposes in the world to bring about his purposes in the world. Pontius Pilate, the angry mob, the Roman guards, none of them were trying to fulfill God's redemptive plan for all of humanity. None of them were attempting to do that. And yet, through that time of extreme darkness and silence, through the death of Jesus, salvation was made possible for all of us, for you, for me, for everyone. And why did that happen? Because sometimes God may be silent, but he is never still. He is always at work, and he is at work in your life and your story today. Let's pray.
Thanks for joining us on the Northgate Podcast. We hope this message has been a blessing to you as you walk with Jesus Christ. For more resources, visit our website at northgatefmc.com or download the Northgate app. Have a wonderful week, and we'll see you next time.